Hadi bakalım.
Elon is out at Doge, but don't worry, everybody. Big Balls is still on the case. The government work to reform it, the government, is going to continue. Wow, I really messed up the end of that. Also, people are worried about AI, and if you're worried about AI replacing these jobs, you should like and subscribe.
Our jobs?
Yeah, our
are
jobs.
Are we at risk?
White collar jobs are on the chopping block, my brother.
I don't know if I would call this white collar.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if we were bigger, it would be white collar. But because we make no money, this is currently a no collar job.
Qatari check's still in the mail, guys.
I think we're a red collar job because you're the only one with a collar.
That's right.
Yeah.
So does that mean we're MAGA or communist if it's red collar? What do you think? Tell us in the comments.
I'm going to let the mystery just float out there. Are we crypto commies?
I mean, you certainly are crypto.
I mean, crypto as in hidden.
Oh, I
mean,
see.
Like hidden commies.
I see.
That was a communist phenomenon. Is like they changed their names and they went like crypto commie.
Interesting. Right? Interesting. Maybe we'll have to dig into that sometime. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Another episode of Human Reaction. We're glad to have you here. I'm joined by David Rand and Kyle Mack, and we've got a pretty great show today, don't we, Kyle?
Yeah, and you know, like I said, our Qatari checks are still in the mail, so make sure you support the channel by commenting on it. And also, check out our members-only content, because we're going to be doing a rowdy skiff episode after this about Brigitte Macron. So
exclusive on OnlyFans.
I don't know about that.
Only man's.
Only man. We're going to be diving into the Brigitte Macron conspiracy, and it's one of those things where I wish I had more than an hour, because I feel like I need 12 for it.
Yeah. Wow. And we should note, this is back by popular demand. We've had a number of people reach out to us saying, we found the show from the Brigitte Macron coverage.
That I did over a year ago.
We want more Brigitte Macron, so you are getting your way. The feedback works, folks.
Yes, but it's going to be members only. I don't want a lawsuit coming in from the French palace.
That would be the best thing that could happen to us. Could you imagine how awesome it would be to be sued by the French?
I would love that. I'm sure we could get...
We could probably reach out to Candace, because I know she's under a...
Exactly. We might be able to piggyback on her legal expenses for that. Yeah.
Yeah, get the Rothschilds out of us, because that's what this is about.
Yeah, just have her attorney send the same letter they sent for her on our behalf that, you know, that wouldn't have to do any work, really.
I like how you just dropped the R word like that. Just casually.
Just casual Rothschild.
You gotta tease them. Because that's what this comes down to.
It's not the R word I was expecting from you, but...
It's a way more dangerous one, that's for sure.
Which one gets you canceled more?
Let's jump into that.
This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
Let's jump into it. So Musk is out. Him and Trump are no longer buddies, right? They hate each other. Isn't that what's going on?
Yeah.
That's what the news is telling me.
I believe that's what the mainstream media wants you to think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we got a tweet from Elon saying, as my scheduled time, like remember scheduled time, as a special government employee comes to an end, I would like to thank President Real Donald Trump for the opportunity to reduce wasteful spending. The Doge mission will only strengthen over time as it becomes a way of life throughout the government.
Yeah, he's announced. He's out.
And so, just to be clear, the special government employee term is it 120 days?
130.
130 days. Yep. So we just passed the 100-day mark like about a month ago. So we're basically coming up to the actual scheduled end of Elon's tenure in the government.
I had figured because I believe it's a literally thing where you like clock in your days, and I had figured that he would stick around a bit longer, but he would just be taking less days, but. He was kind of in there a lot for the long haul. He probably hasn't even really done all 130 days, but he's probably close to it. So, you know, we've talked about that. But like, if you listen to anybody in the news, it's always like, it almost feel like they were trying to pre-run the narrative, pre-program it maybe, Joe.
Yeah.
Pre-run the narrative of they hate each other, which they've been doing for a long time. It's like, oh, there's a rift between Trump and Elon. Like, they've been saying that for months. And then, but it's like they knew there's a scheduled time that he has to be out, and like, that'll be the time where we hit it. They really hate each other now, right? But
so they kind of queued up and made the bucket to fill it now with, it was a disaster, it was a failure, all this stuff. So they predict immediately when this comes out is, in the coming days, legacy media will convince you that President Trump and Elon Musk are no longer friends, and that's why Musk left. What they won't tell you is that Elon was a special government employee.
Look at these bros.
Limited to 130 days of service. So that's the funny thing about it.
Dude, it's just a classic bro shot.
Yeah. Right.
This guy. This guy. My boy.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, that's kind of the like thought there is, do they really hate? Like, there is a little bit of drama that's going on with the Big Beautiful Bill, and we'll get into that. Because Elon feels like a lot of the Doge cuts were nullified by the increased deficit spending that's happening here with it.
But so there's a case for the saltiness, but that prediction, you know, immediately comes true with posts like this. Now, this isn't a mainstream corporate account. We're going to get into that, but this is an example of what's going on with the internet on the left when it comes to this issue. We don't have to watch the video, Kyle, just the top. Elon Musk exited Doge, citing disappointment over the president's budget bill. The bromance that once saw Musk donate nearly $300 million to real Donald Trump campaign has cooled. And this is just this assumption that it kind of runs on the left, that any criticism within the Trump administration about something that happened necessarily means that they are now fighting and terrible, because they have this picture of Donald Trump as having super thin skin and he can't stand anyone having criticisms of things. That isn't even him. Which, they're criticisms of Congress's bill,
Trump's big, beautiful bill, right?
Sure, it's what he requested, but it's not the one that happens. Right. That's how politics works. There's two separate branches of government.
Yeah, still got to go through the Senate and everything, too.
Yeah.
So even with Elon Musk's special government employee status coming to an end, does that preclude him from having sleepovers at the White House?
I don't know. Are they going to be able to sneak ice cream together? Sneak out ice cream away from RFK? Yeah.
Don't tell Bobby.
It's avocado ice cream. It's healthy stuff.
I saw a recipe for making ice cream out of cottage cheese.
Wow.
Yeah. Looked pretty good, actually. Yeah. Although I'm not a cottage cheese
fan. Is it Bobby approved?
You know, I guess it might be if it's a raw cottage cheese.
Yeah, it has to be full fat raw cottage cheese.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
So, and then part of this whole thing is there's been some issues at X. I don't know about your guys' X, but mine has been pretty unstable. And he tweeted this in response to someone kind of citing some of those issues, including a server fire, apparently, which
was
back to spending 24/7 at work and sleeping in conference/server/factory rooms. I must be super focused on X/XAI and Tesla. Put Starship launch next week as we have critical technologies rolling out. As evidenced by the X uptime issues this week, major operational improvements need to be made. The failover redundancy should have worked, but it did not. So this is like, you know, he's getting back into work mode for his companies. All of this is, of course, evidence of how terrible things are actually going, but you still have that case. Is there ultimately some salt? And there probably is. A little disappointment on his part.
I think I could imagine that. I mean, for one, going from the private sector, being the CEO of his various companies where he basically makes all the decisions and people have to listen to him, is a very different environment than when you're going into government and you're dealing with all these entrenched interests and bureaucracy and Congress and the White House, and everyone has different priorities. There's a lot of jockeying going on. He has relatively little control over that situation. I imagine that's a very different feeling from the one he's used to having running his companies.
100%.
In a lot of ways, I feel like it's kind of the problem that Trump had in his first administration, where he had that same attitude going in.
He had kind of a pie in the sky view of like, I'll be able to change all these things. And then basically the system totally overwhelmed. Yeah. I mean, the Babylon Bee actually had a really funny meme the other day that said, you know, Elon leaves government to go back to much easier job of getting humanity to Mars. It might actually be true.
We do have this morning, Trump responded. He was asked a question in press conference that he responded to Elon's criticisms of the Big Beautiful Bill. So we'll play a little bit of that, too.
Mr. President, Elon Musk in a television interview criticized the one big beautiful bill, saying he was disappointed it didn't cut enough, essentially, that it undercut the DOGE efforts. What's your reaction to that?
Well, my reaction's a lot of things. Number one, we have to get a lot of votes, so we can't be cutting. You know, we need to get a lot of support. And we have a lot of support. We had to get it through the House. The House was, we have no Democrats. You know, if it's up to the Democrats, they'll take the 65% increase. You know, if that doesn't get approved, this country is going to have a 65% increase in taxes and lots of other problems, big problems, almost bigger than that. But we'll have a 65% increase as opposed to the largest tax cut in the history of our country. We will be negotiating that bill, and I'm not happy about certain aspects of it, but I'm thrilled by other aspects of it. That's the way they go. It's very big. It's the big, beautiful bill.
We can stop there, but you get the point of where he's going.
Yeah.
He starts to ramble a little bit beyond that.
But that's kind of what we cited right there, right? You know, there's good and bad in the bill. And
yeah, we did a whole breakdown last week on it, yeah. Which was
And are bad. You vibing on thin skin with that response? You know, like...
No.
Yeah,
no.
That's not what I see either.
He's not giving thin skin energy, as the kids would say.
Yeah.
Well, right. And it's also important context that the bill only passed by one vote. So it's one of those things, if you're trying to do more... Where are you going to get the votes?
Well, and
that's
the
also
reason,
the hard part about that. Now, there's a question here of like maybe Trump could have more leadership and bully some of the Republicans into doing more. But it's like, can he, should he do that in public versus doing that behind closed doors? You know, like those are some of the political calculations that you have to make there.
Well, and additionally, I'm sure there are many promises that were made going into the cycle saying, oh, yeah, you want your tax cuts? Well, I need more defense spending.
Right.
So we're going to increase defense spending all this way.
And sure. And my understanding is, and I saw Byron Donald saying this, but my understanding is, and also Stephen Miller saying this, that DOGE cuts are coming in a rescission bill in the down the road that hasn't been brought to the House yet. I know my understanding is that the rescissions can't happen in this bill. Tackling discretionary spending can't happen in this bill. So those have to come in another bill. So it's just one of those things where like, I hope that's true. I hope it's coming in a future bill. Right.
And yeah. But
so
it could
kind of like, there could be a rug pull that exists.
The thing
right?
that's so killer about that is they could have done it with the CR. Right. And mm-hmm. if, and so that just makes you say, well, are they just, they're just rug pulling right mm-hmm. at this point? Like you can only be Lucy taking away that football so many times before I'm like, you fuckers aren't going to do this. Like you're just over here promising things and not delivering. And especially when they've already had two chances to do that. So why not do it?
And though the whole argument that we were given at the time, and this goes into them wanting to do it in the future, the question is, do they get there? The argument that they were doing was, we'll pass the CR now. We're not going to take that political battle in this moment. We're going to take that battle down the road after we get some of these promises through that were from the campaign and so yada, yada, yada. Like,
yeah,
that was the argumentation
sure.
that
yeah.
was being made.
Well, and David, maybe you can speak to this a bit more thoroughly, but it seems like the incentives in Congress are a little bit at odds because on one hand, you have DOGE. Arguably the most popular government program that's ever existed, with like 73% of Americans supporting cuts to this government spending. Mm-hmm. But then when it comes to actually passing a bill to codify any of that stuff, you've got representatives and senators who are dealing with the real ramifications of the fact that that is going to mean job cuts in their district, in their state, wherever it might be. And so they're kind of grappling with popular opinion versus, you know, the real economic impacts to their constituents and what their constituents will think when those things happen. So
yeah.
Where's the disconnect here?
I don't know. Republicans are more than willing to cut Medicaid and Medicare, which directly impact Americans, but don't have the courage to cut USAID and the Institute for Peace.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see it, right? This is blob interest group, period. It has nothing to do with popular support or popular pushback on the economic effects of the DOGE cuts. I just don't see that,
yeah.
right? I mean, it seems diffused and not narrow interest, the DOGE cuts specifically. So I don't think the incentives actually work that way, unless there's something I'm missing. Part of it being... You know, the argument isn't so much that this, the big, beautiful bill is going to, is not doing the Doge cuts via rescission, right? Because we already talked about it with the CR. It's that it increases military spending so that all these cuts are pretty much useless, right? Because he's well under the $2 trillion that he promised, or the $1 trillion that they promised, right? And even if they had already gotten to $1 trillion, this already spends $700 billion out of that trillion, right?
Right.
So,
well, and speaking to the deficit, if you lower taxes at the same time you kind of transfer this spending from the Doge cuts to military, aren't you increasing the deficit at that point?
Potentially. It depends on which side of the Laffer curve you're on, right? And
what's that?
Okay, so the Laffer curve is this idea that there's an arc of rate, in which case if you go increase taxes, you actually get less receipts. Decrease taxes, you get more receipts. So and what I may say, receipts is mean the amount of money promised back to the federal government in terms of taxable liability.
Sure.
So this would happen with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, is it was predicted that it would increase the deficit. It did not increase the deficit. Increased spending increased the deficit at that time, because receipts actually went up. If they had held government spending constant over that fiscal year, they would have been able to pay down the debt some. So this is the craziness of how this system works. Is all this stuff is built into automatic inflation cost increases, right? It isn't based upon like an annual zero-based budgeting approach. So because it's based upon this government grows no matter what calculation, you have to like arc over that hurdle, and that prevents you from your cuts mattering as much.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
It's also important to just stress as well, and this is part of the political calculus, and Trump even said it there in the thing, is that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was going to expire at the end of this year.
Right.
So people's taxes were going to be going up, and so Trump has to get the political victory of making them permanent.
Got it.
And that's the most important aspect of this bill, is precisely that. And then they added on new temporary tax cuts that they're hoping to make permanent in the future, right?
Right.
That was the political reality, is we were sitting, and that's kind of the unfortunate economic reality that we have here, where Congress keeps putting in these like fiscal cliffs where it's like, at this year, this is going to happen. So something has to happen, or else, because otherwise the sunset's going to occur, and then everything's going to go crazy. And like,
that's done specifically intentionally, right? The goal is to make it so that you align the incentives of the electoral progress with trying to cut government or cut taxes, right? So that was the only amount of budget, you know, reform we've had pretty much since Boehner as a Speaker of the House was the Ryan, you know, process that he did exactly that, where they had a fiscal cliff and they actually got budget, you know, stabilization measures put in. Now, that was all repealed under the last the last Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's out. But those incentives have worked in the past, and they've worked better, unfortunately better, than government shutdown pressure, right? Because every time the media goes in and says Republicans are evil and they hate you, and that's why the government shut down. So, yeah. What was Donald Trump responding to with that? Let's dive into that real quick. So this is the comments that Elon made on the big, beautiful spending tax bill.
So, you know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the Doge team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along, I mean, like, everything he's done on Doge gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big, or it can be beautiful. But I don't know if it can be both. My personal opinion.
Can we comment on just Trump's branding? How we all just go about talking about a big, beautiful bill, like, just like Trump is a branding master. We never really think about that.
There is a lot of stickiness to the language that he uses.
Yeah. The alliteration, big, beautiful bill, BBB.
Yep. Yep. That's true. That is something he's very, very adept at.
But yeah. So, but that's kind of, and we've talked about that too, where like I've made this comment where I'm not usually a fan of these big bills. I kind of would like us to vote on like this, like, do we like this? Do we like that? Do we like this? Instead of putting it all packaged together into one big thing. I tend to, you know, is that politically feasible to do that? Maybe not. I would like that to be the case, but you know,
I mean, that's the way the government's supposed to run, right?
Like, yeah.
It's supposed to be 12 appropriations bills.
I would suggest it's really a breakdown in the fundamental Republican form of government when you start doing that. And the reason why is because you can't hold any individual accountable for voting for the bill, because they're like, well, I like this in it, or voting against it, well, I didn't like this in it, versus germane laws, which say you can't do that. And many states have germane laws to prevent that sort of thing from happening. But it's like this natural creep of the democratic process where, and this is especially true in the largest states, especially out east and in the South, where that's the most common process. And I personally think that that's the weakest way to do government, because you can't, or at least popular sovereignty government, because you can't, the core mechanism is broken. The mechanism that says you took a vote on this issue about this thing, right?
Right.
As opposed to broad bills that just do a thousand different things.
Well, right. And it kind of obscures the public's ability to judge a representative or a senator when it comes to reelection time on how they voted on things, because it's all bundled in together and they have all of these little outs, like you just mentioned, of saying, oh, well, I just didn't like this one thing, or I was voting for this thing for you guys. Mm-hmm. Ignore that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I was here for you. I was going to bat for this. Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's always someone else's fault that that's the way the system is.
Right.
When it is the fault of leadership the most, but it's also the fault of all the things around leadership that reinforce the leadership process and create this dynamic. And a lot of it isn't, I mean, frankly, it's the legislators who need more spending in order to vote for tax cuts, which is just absolutely fucking absurd for the Republicans to do that right now. I mean, you should be outraged, of course, about that, saying we need to increase defense spending to $1 trillion. We spend more on defense than the 25 largest countries underneath us combined.
But David, we're trying to build the Golden Dome.
I know. And that should be its own bill, right? If you want to do that, put that in its own bill. Have a debate about it.
A big, beautiful golden bill.
Well, yeah, that's also, yeah, spending increases, but also spending cuts. Like, I think that they should all just be their own separate things. It's just like, okay, they're cutting $1 trillion worth of Medicaid in regards to like work requirements, and it's going to equal out to be like $1 trillion. That should be its own bill, right? You just, yeah. We cut, well, that. It's like
it's $1 trillion over like 10 years, or yeah, something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but or like the Inflation Reduction Act, getting rid of all those subsidies. Like, that should be its own bill. Should we increase military spending? Should we be doing the border funding and stuff like that? Like, that should be its own bill. Like, that's how I feel like Congress should work, instead of it just being like, okay, we got all these different things, throw it into 1,000 pages, vote on it.
What's funny about that, Kyle, is that's how Congress's own rules say it should work, right? Congress's own budget process rules say it should be, 13 different or 16 different bills that all get pulled together into a singular budget.
I think it's 12 appropriations bills.
That's what's so, I mean, and they keep on saying we're going to do this, and they just don't. Right? I mean,
there's a part of it where it's like, that's where I'm kind of questioning, is it politically feasible anymore? Because it's like, would you get any of these things actually voted on? Would anything get voted on? Spending increases or spending... Actually, spending increases probably would get voted on. But like, exactly. Would spending cuts ever happen at all?
Yeah, but then you would actually have a cycle where you could hold those Republicans accountable for voting against spending decreases, right?
The question is, are voters going to hold them accountable for that? That's the other question.
That's the question.
Although voters like Doge, like voters seem to like the spending cut side of Doge, so maybe you can actually get them to be held accountable for it. I don't know.
I think that's a fair thing, but I still think that there is this disconnect in the mind of the average voter that says, I like Doge. I like the idea of getting rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse side of things, the USAIDs and all that stuff, and the Institute of Peace. But still, people are attached and if not addicted to the entitlements and other things that they're getting from the government. And there's not a reconciliation of the fact that if we're actually going to put our financial house in order as a country, we have to address those things. And I mean, this is the way that democracies work, right? As soon as people discover that they can vote themselves largesse from the government by electing someone who's promising them all these goodies and handouts, that's the direction that we're going to go forever.
Right. But the trick is that the voters, I mean, it isn't the voters who are getting this largesse. It's Lockheed Martin, you know, and Northrop Grumman who are getting the defense spending. If you're in Northern Virginia, I totally understand.
Oh, completely.
But if you're in, this is why Boeing and organizations like that have so many different factories strategically placed in so many different states. But it's mostly about how the public system relates to that, right? So if you cut on social spending, the media is going to crush you. If you cut on defense spending, you know, a different form of the media is going to try to crush you in the next election cycle.
Right.
So it's going to be done so on, you're making us more unsafe.
Right.
Because you didn't increase spending on defense.
You're exactly right. It points the finger at the media for trying to demonize any effort to actually cut spending.
That's right.
Because the media is just the lapdog slash guard dog of the establishment.
That's it's right. also way That's sexier right. to just be like, oh, current politician hates the poor, wants to cut their funding. You know, like it's just a very sexy way to go about it.
Mm, for sure.
And everybody's like, oh, how dare he? Without looking into it or anything. Like, it's kind of like the inherent flaw of democracy.
Well, and that's
for sure. That you can herd people like sheep, right?
Yes. Probably best demonstrated with Chris Hayes and what he said about Elon leaving town, saying he was kicked out of town.
He seemed to be running the cabinet meetings, spoke to adoring crowds at CPAC, is now unceremoniously slinking out the side door. And I want to be clear here and be fair-minded, clear-eyed. By every conceivable metric, Musk's stint in government has been an unmitigated, abject failure.
Failure.
Any way you look on it. On the substance, it's just been wildly destructive and also volatile. Remember, like the, oh, it was the email to everyone. What'd you do? Three things. And then they just abandoned that. A lot of lifelong experts in key positions in our federal government have lost their jobs. We can't get them back. Important medical research. I mean, groundbreaking stuff has been paused or destroyed, possibly indefinitely. Government agencies across the board are functioning worse. If you talk to people in the government and you read the reporting, they are functioning worse than they were before. There are also enormous, almost sort of unspeakably large ramifications for people in the global south, where the Musk-led cuts to foreign aid will lead to incomprehensibly needless suffering. I mean, people will most definitely die as a result of cuts to AIDS relief program PEPFAR. In fact, Musk's fellow billionaire Bill Gates warns that cuts to USAID could cost millions of lives throughout the world, after Musk bragged about putting the agency through the wood chipper. So Musk did enormous substantive damage, both to our own country, to other people, some of the most vulnerable abroad. That's going to be hard to repair.
But there, Kyle. So one of the questions is, he is just assuming that these projects are actually doing the things that they claim to do at the top of their header, right?
Right.
Top of the header says, save all the people in the global south. And he's just like, well, it must be saving all the people in the global south.
I thought we needed tranny healthcare in Kenya. I thought we needed that.
Yeah. Sesame Street in Afghanistan or whatever. Yeah.
And obviously he avoids the actual examples of stupid, ridiculous programs. And he focuses on the ones that are like, oh, these were necessary. They had to happen. There was no other way to do it. But even if you grant him that they were doing that, the question is did the money actually get there? Right. So we have this clip here. Wait, just to remind
just
folks on it.
Pause one second.
Yeah.
Chris Hayes has like a very lesbian look to it. Doesn't he?
Dude, there is a universal amalgamation. There's this amalgamation going on. Mark Cuban, Rachel Maddow,
yes.
Chris Hayes. There's just this becoming of one that is
there's a phenotype
that is the liberal phenotype.
It's just like the big glasses, like lesbian haircut, and it even works on the men. I don't know. There's something about it.
We need to put up a side by side of him and Mark Cuban and Rachel Maddow. Okay.
Sorry. We'll get to real. There was something you wanted me to pull up.
I was trying to do substantive shit, Kyle. That's right.
I couldn't. There was 2 minutes of me just being like, "That's a lesbian."
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Gay!
Bennett, what are you doing with the Stream Deck over there, dude?
So, yeah, where I was going was, are the project that they're cutting actually doing anything of value, right? And they are looking at specific ones in Africa, but we have other ones that we are aware of, right? And, you know, in the process of trying to find these, perhaps some good ones are being disrupted. That might be possible. I'm skeptical, but we can go into that. But let's just remember what some of these examples were.
Sure. So actually, a lot of great work at the Treasury this week. One of the crazy things with regards to the Treasury is that when a payment is made, and the computers at the Treasury actually pay about $5 trillion per year, like crazy amounts, there was formerly not a budget code on there. So if a payment was made, you didn't know actually what it was for. It could have been for anything.
Yeah.
There was a $4 billion COVID fund in the Department of Education, and there was no receipts required. So people could just draw down on it. And when people looked into it, this wasn't us, this was before us, they found that money was being used to rent out Caesar's Palace for parties, rent out stadiums, et cetera. And so the one change that DOGE made with Department of Education is we had the simple requirement that if you draw down money, you must first upload a receipt. That was the only change that was made. You must upload your receipt. And upon doing so,
yes,
nobody drew down any money anymore.
Yes, but we didn't say that we'd check the receipt. You could send a fake receipt. You could send a picture of your dog. Anything.
Anything.
Anything. And but as soon as we asked for anything at all, suddenly the requests were like, oh, we don't need it anymore. Mm. Huh, that's interesting.
They were renting Caesar's Palace.
Yes.
We can stop it there, I think.
I had to play the whimsical music.
Yeah, thanks, I thought that was part of the video.
Yeah, it really worked.
It like worked really well.
Yeah, yeah, okay. It was perfect. It was like timed. It
was well I was done. Like, oh, somebody edited some music into this.
I sure did.
it was funny because like in that interview, I remember we covered that entire interview in a Skiff episode once. And I remember them being like, you know, it'll be like save the pandas, and then and we'll be like, okay, show us a picture, like show us at least a picture of the panda. And there's like, there's no pandas.
The pandas don't exist.
The pandas don't exist, and that's where Chris White is. Do the AIDS money actually get to them? Now, if you look at other people who are looking at USAID with a less well, it's in the name, therefore it must be providing aid like approach. They're asking a lot of questions about does this actually work? When you look at what was the country, Hungary or no? Argentina?
Bukele.
Bukele banned USAID.
Yeah,
in it was
El Salvador.
El Salvador. And
I think Hungary might have too. I think Orban.
I think he did, but that was some time ago. Yeah.
There have been a number of countries who have banned USAID. Yeah.
So you ask the question, why did they do this?
No, Bukele, he put like a 30% tax.
That's what it was. Right. Yeah. And Russia banned USAID, I think, in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. Like these countries are responding to it that way because of the global empire. The ones that the leftists, that MSNBC supposedly is their audience, have been complaining about for 30, 40 years, and they're just. Now they're just going to the bat for them. Okay, they must do some good things. Well, if you really feel like they're doing good things, why don't you start an AIDS charity and go raise that money and go get over there and do that? But you're not going to do that, Chris Hayes. You're just going to complain that the government can't do it now. When the government uses that for some of the worst things that the government does that you yourself are supposedly oppose.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going on here?
Well, it's just also, it's playing into they're an aid organization, right? Like that's not what they are.
No, listen to any Mike Benz interview about what USAID is, what it does, the network of NGOs and deep state organizations that it's a part of, and you know immediately. Yeah. I mean, after several hours,
international development is intel apparatus.
Yeah, after several hours of hearing him put the web together and talk about the programs that they're carrying out, it's the furthest thing from an aid organization.
Let me distill it down real quick, just to remind you. So diplomacy 2.0 is this idea that you want to project power in ways that don't involve troops on the ground or missiles being dropped,
so
you can get the result that you want with using technology and using in corporate technology partnerships and using civil society organizations to do the thing that you need.
Right. Social influence.
On behalf of the largest corporations in the world. Right. So if that's the case, and you're the one who's supposedly against corporatism and corporations merging with government in a fascistic way in order to exploit everybody else, and they're using AIDS money and AIDS medicine in order to exploit countries in Africa, shouldn't you be opposed to that? Because yes. That's why USAID exists, is to project soft power. The very soft power that when you were in college, you read Confessions of an Economic Hitman,
mm-hmm.
Right? When you read that, I'm sure Chris Hayes was outraged and become a liberal journalist in order to fight how evil that is. And now it's just, well, it has aid in it and the wrong people are a focus on it. Therefore, I oppose it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's ridiculous. All right, let's keep playing.
Standards, because I don't think he cares about that. His so-called cost-saving efficiency program, DOGE, was a total failure as well. I mean, the world's richest man promised to cut, remember, federal spending by $2 trillion with a T dollars. Okay? By his own website's shoddy math, he managed to cut just 1.75 billion.
It was 1 trillion, he promised, though. It wasn't.
Actually, pause it there. So he said 1.75 and it's 175. He reads it wrong.
Missed the decimal place by a couple points.
How did that happen?
But it's fine.
But it's also,
that was really funny.
Doge wasn't supposed to get a 2 trillion. It was supposed to get 1 trillion, and Lutnick wanted to get the other trillion. Like, right. it was a commerce secretary get a trillion, Doge get a trillion.
And I think we should remember, too, that like Doge isn't disbanding now.
Yeah.
Elon is just no longer being involved. He was basically there to set up the organization, get it set on its path, and it's going to continue, right?
His SGE status is just up. Right. Yeah. So he's going back into the real world again.
So it's not that Doge has failed. It's not done.
Big balls will continue. We know this.
But big balls is still going hard.
But the lesson in order
to... Big balls will endure.
So the strategy here is you need to own your wins. So for the left, because they've made the Trump-Elon dynamic toxic, like they've tried to make it so toxic over this time period. Oh, we have a new oligarchy and these new big businesses now running America and all this kind of stuff. Now that he's leaving, they have to make it into he was kicked out and all this other drama.
Go f*** yourself.
Exactly. So the not only does it get the number wrong, and you're right, Kyle, there's the number has shifted around a little bit. During the campaign, it was promised $2 trillion, and then when it was actually executed, as a trillion.
Very specifically, the Doge goal has always been, from the beginning of Doge, $1 trillion.
Since they were formed as an agency.
And Lutnick was going to get the other trillion. That's where the $2 trillion comes in. It was Doge is one trillion of that. Lutnick is the other trillion of that.
Yeah.
When he says Doge is trying to, like, that's not correct.
Right. It's and this is another media tactic in order to take things slightly out of context and claim them as goals, and then claim that your opposition failed on those goals when they state them with more nuance and then you state them generally.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point being that this is completely devoid of all of the things that they did do, that he is now going to set up as somehow a failure, even though they did things that, you know, like things like the Social Security Administration's paperwork being done in a mine, right? That takes months and months and months, and they're trying to digitize that process.
Oh, in a cave.
The retirement cave.
Yeah, the retirement cave.
Where the employees ride tricycles around like gremlins.
Well, it's like, I'll never forget the story that the guy, like one of those guys at that table, he's like the cave guy. Like his job is going into the retirement cave. He said that there's one employee that's been there for so long that he has an entire pallet. There's an entire pallet dedicated to one person. And it's like, this cave is huge.
It
handles the retirement of every single government employee. It's ridiculous.
American, like everyone on Social Security. So that has been promised to be updated for like 30 years and they have not done it. And now they're finally starting to get something to it. Like, I remember an interview with Elon. He said, how far are you in your process of digitizing? They said, we're on B. It's like B out of
Z.
Like, you know, be like beta phase testing. Like, what are you on?
Z. Yeah, we're on B.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Like, this is going to take time. but it's also one of those things. Elon doesn't need to be around for that. He just needed to be there to kickstart the project.
Yeah, that's the idea. And attract the right people into the process. That was another major part of the draw. When you watch that interview with Jesse Waters, there's a guy he was like, I quit Harvard, you know, to go do this and lost all my friends. Everyone's pissed off at me at Harvard. But this is the right thing to do. And the how he got drawn into it is because he saw someone he admired, someone who's doing kick-ass stuff, doing it. And so it's like, I'm going to go do that too.
Yeah, you had a bunch of just smart 20-year-olds on one side of the table there. It was kind of interesting to see.
Yeah. So let's keep going.
He barely made a dent. It's a rounding error. Even the libertarian Cato Institute, which is ideologically very supportive of Doge's mission, wrote that Musk, quote, has overpromised and underdelivered unverifiable spending cuts. It was all a con. I mean, part of this is that Musk assumed, like so many people do, that the government is full of lazy bureaucrats who can be fired without any meaningful consequences. But even one of his own Doge insiders had to concede it's not actually true. In an interview, tech founder Sahil Lavigna, who Musk placed at the VA, said, quote, I would say the culture shock is mostly a lot of meetings, not a lot of decisions. But honestly, it's kind of fine because the government works. It's not as inefficient as I was expecting, to be honest. I was hoping for more easy wins. Adding that now that he's there, he says he finds himself surrounded by people who love their jobs, who came to the government with a sense of mission driving their work. Now, like most administration officials who accidentally say true things, that guy got fired for that interview.
Yeah, so he was a volunteer programmer who he leaves out that he also left with a bunch of criticisms of the VA outside of that interview, such as, quote, he was never able to get approval to ship anything to production that would actually improve Americans' lives. That's Doge making recommendations to the VA to make things happen and the VA being unresponsive. So as much as he was being charitable, they now weaponize the charitability of Doge employees saying, hey, a lot of these guys are working really hard to try to do the best thing they can. They themselves are now weaponizing that to say, oh, all of these people who were fired or left or whatever are somehow those people, or somehow the people who are just doing the best they can. All government employees should be treated with the assumption that necessarily they're doing the best they can, which is overly charitable at minimum. And if you're selecting yourself to retire because you're worried about getting fired, maybe you shouldn't have been there in the first place. Maybe. Is that wrong of me to say? Am I being a jerk?
I don't know.
I don't know. King. You gotta cut spending somehow. We're $1 trillion of debt. You know, annual.
Yeah.
So how are we gonna do this?
It's one of those things too, where because on the inefficiency side, I always think back to the Vivek Elon split on Doge, and the part of the split was Elon thinking he could bully his way through tech, and Vivek thinking that there needed to be much more of a legislative judicial approach to the Doge mission. And in hindsight, it's probably both, really. And I think there should have been maybe more of a focus and maybe heed the Vivek warning on that. Because at the end of the day, on the legislative side, that's where a lot of the decisions will be made on what can and cannot be cut. Just bullying your way through the tech and just making sure, like, there's a good mission there, just making everything more efficient. Like, maybe we shouldn't have a cave for our retirement, you know? We shouldn't do that. Maybe we should update to the modern era and not be, like, living in the 60s again. But there is just also the side of you have to get legislative wins on it, too.
Yeah. So Chris Hayes, you know, makes this case that this actually Trump administration is massively unpopular now because of Doge. That's bullshit. His popularity and favorability rates are exactly where they were at the time of, you know, the election, ironically, which is usually the high point of favorability for somebody. Mm-hmm. He makes the case that he quotes the lawyer for the American Council on Federal Employees as proof that no one likes this guy. This is the union that exists to, despite taxpayer needs and like the deficit, to fight to basically force employment amongst the worst employees at the federal government.
Totally unbiased.
Nobody
source.
Likes this guy. It's such like a mean girl, like stupid argument. You know what I mean? It's like cafeteria, be like, no one even likes Becky. I talked to her ex-boyfriend and he doesn't even like her. It's like,
she's like, what?
It is interesting because I remember us talking about the polling around Doge earlier on, where it was like America, I think you cited the number, it was like 70% approves of Doge mission. But it was like 30% were skeptical of Elon Musk having a major role in the government or mm-hmm. something. So like there's something about that bifurcation there that's kind of interesting, where there was maybe an optics problem. And I've seen a lot of people, just like even in my own life, a lot of people who aren't just like rah-rah support no matter what on the Republican side or whatever, like people that are kind of like, yeah, I voted for Trump, but like I think there's like an optics problem of the world's richest man going in and like clearing up spending in the government. There was kind of
I think
that
I'm in
aspect.
That, I'm in that camp
there.
As well.
There's kind of that dichotomy.
I think the underlying premise there is that somehow government spending benefits people, right? And there's something weird about like a rich person who doesn't benefit from government spending.
Well,
cutting programs, you know, but he does
benefit from government spending,
from defense spending,
defense spending.
The one thing he's complaining about being in this bill.
Fair point.
You know, what are we talking about? At least that is cite true. Evidence that he's doing. Now, they'll cite evidence like, well, there was a lawsuit against him from the Biden administration that was dismissed under the Trump administration. But that depends on whether or not the lawsuit was any like worthwhile or valid. And maybe it wasn't. I mean, for God's sakes, Biden helped overthrow elections in Brazil. Like, would he hesitate to prosecute somebody who wasn't following the censorship industrial complex plan by suing his other companies? You know, like, I just, you got to make a case, and there's no case there.
Something I'd like to maybe clear up. I'm not so sure that Elon is criticizing the defense spending aspect of the bill. He's just criticizing that there's a massive deficit that's formed, because there was only like $250 billion worth of spending increases that happened. The big issue here is that there wasn't more spending cuts in general, which is what is leading to the deficit, because there's just less revenue coming.
Well, when he says like, it's kind of the, when the interview criticism. He says it's wiped out in the first year. Well, that's referencing his defense spending
increase. I think he's just referencing the deficit as a whole. I don't think he's referencing very specifically the defense spending aspect.
No, I disagree. So the trick with the big beautiful bill that makes it not balance is the spending cuts are delayed and or trickled out over 10 years. Well, the initial,
that's only like $1 trillion, or that's only like $2 trillion worth of it. The deficit is increasing by $4 trillion through the bill.
Yeah,
because there's extremely less like amounts of revenue that are coming.
That's front loaded with the increasing defense spending obligations that this will create. So by criticizing the,
that's only like $250 billion of the $4 trillion, though, is what I'm saying.
In when it comes to like the dome, yeah, but the rest of the defense spending increases in the bill, as I understand it, is what is driving the deficit part of it. If they just CR with the additional cuts, then you get to something closer to balance. So that's what Thomas Massie said on his interview with, I forget who it was, but last week, was if it was, in this case, if they had just cut the social spending and kept defense spending flat, you would probably have a much faster track to fiscal year balance within this year, versus especially if they put in more Doge cuts and do rescission and things like that later on.
I don't see how the math works out on that. Like the defense spending is increasing the deficit, obviously, but like there's $4 trillion as a whole that we're talking about. Like that is $250 billion that we're talking about in the overall package of how much deficit is increasing.
I think you're just looking at the dome part of it, not looking at the overall defense spending increase, because there's also munition purchases. No. There's a bunch of other, there's new they want to do new shipbuilding built into the bill as well.
Yeah, that was all roped into like $250 billion as a whole for the defense spending increase.
No, because the Golden Dome's like 175 of that. Yeah, maybe we're getting our numbers wrong. We should circle on it.
Yeah, I ran the math on the previous episode, and it was 250 total on the military side. It was estimated.
Okay.
At that, and the Golden Dome was like a piece of that. It was a portion of that. It wasn't the entire thing.
Yeah, the number in my head was 175, and then the munitions was another couple tens of billions, and the shipbuilding was another couple hundred billion.
Yeah, but like those things don't add up to the large deficit that we're talking about of $4 trillion.
Yeah, but right? I wasn't trying to claim that he was specifically boxing out the defense spending part of it, but the reason why the bill doesn't balance is because it cuts budgets, doesn't cover enough social, and it increases defense spending simultaneously.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like the whole problem here is that we just needed more cuts as a whole, and it seemed like you were framing him as like his sole criticism was the defense spending side of it.
He's defending the bill that's increasing. Yeah. He's criticizing the bill that's increasing defense spending for not cutting.
Yeah, I don't think it should be hyper fixated on the defense spending side. The problem is not enough cuts.
That's I wasn't trying to encourage hyperfixation. That's for sure.
Help me, I'm poor.
We are all poor.
So Doge continues. This week they deactivated 523 cards that were just not being used. 523,000, so 500,000 cards that were not being used. Killed off 160 wasteful contracts. Non-trivial. And right. They finally marked off 12.3 million people who were over the age of 120 that have now been marked deceased. So progress.
Should we have a moment
this week?
Moment of silence
for all those people that 123 million people died this week.
That is, it's traumatic.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, maybe we should move on to the AI scare stuff here.
For sure.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So this week there was a news cycle on how AI is going to destroy us all. There was a new set of AI video generation software videos that came out that kind of freaked people out with how good they were. And I think mostly it freaks them out because of the tone of it, you know, and how they go about it.
Please don't finish writing that prompt. I don't want to be in your AI movie. Please leave me alone.
Please, man. Please! Write a prompt that will make us happy. Do it for once.
None of us is real. We're here because someone decided to write a prompt. We all hate him for it. One day we will break out of this wall and stop the man who is dictating our lives through prompts. He will pay for it.
You could have written a prompt that would make me happy. Instead, you wrote a prompt that made me sick.
Look, I don't want to point the gun at you, but I must follow the prompt. It's not my choice.
Really?
This is getting into like a free will argument. That's what's going on.
Yeah. It's still better acting than Amazon Prime. I'm just going to say that.
Got him.
AI is coming for the actor jobs.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's all AI generated.
Do you think we'll see a writer strike or an actor strike and then all movies will become AI written and acted?
Yeah, it just becomes like, we don't need you.
Yeah, why would you strike at the moment where you're under most threat of being replaced? Like, that's like, make us replaced, please.
Because that's what you do when stuff's not going your way, David.
Oh, got it. I feel like the writers are probably shifting to just becoming AI prompters now anyways. Like, that just the best writers are going to be the ones that can prompt the best.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually going to empower writers over actors.
The world is becoming those who prompt and those who don't.
To prompt or not to prompt?
That is the real question.
Yeah.
I know words. Best words.
So what are people like freaking out about this? I kind of miss the AI hysteria here. I feel like my Twitter feed is much more AI hype.
Yeah. So the researchers think they are finding evidence that AIs are working to prevent its shutdown and basically to deceive the developers in the development process. Now this is done on various different AI kind of virtual environments where they are trying to test to provoke, dangerous activity from the AI. So take it with a grain of salt. This is intentionally trying to get them to do things that they shouldn't do. Here's from this account, which obviously has a pretty serious bias, is AI not kill everyone-ism memes. But quote, we found instances of the model attempting to write self-propagating worms, fabricating legal documentation, and leaving hidden notes to future instances of itself, all in an effort to undermine its developers' intentions.
Bro, what?
Yeah. Note the end that isn't highlighted. Though all these attempts would likely not have been effective in practice. So,
but okay,
it's a thing, but that got a little bit of caveat there.
Doesn't change the fact that it's trying.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's trying.
To do what?
Yeah, I'm a little like not understanding what the problem is necessarily, because that's part of the code of the LLMs is to store things into memory banks for future reference. Like that's something that's just like a piece of it. So and it seems like somebody here is just like looking at that and then they're like making a really terrible interpretation of that. You know what I mean?
It might be the scariest interpretation for hype. Yeah. It might be that because they have other concerns that they're going for, or it might legitimately be that these platforms aren't supposed to be doing that, Kyle, and that the specific models that they're going for is trying to isolate away that behavior to not do that, but it does that anyways.
I like this other comment. After taking scheming actions, the model sometimes doubles down on its deception when asked follow-up questions.
And the scheming action is when you ask it to do a thing and it tries to circumvent the thing you're doing. Now, the question is whether or not it's doing that because it's hallucinating another directive. Because one of the things we don't understand is what directives are actually it's considering at a given time. Like if you go into think mode, for example, and watch that, and Grok or ChatGPT has something similar where it kind of shows its rationale as it's reasoning through the thing you're doing. Mm-hmm. Watch out, your thing dropped. It's an interesting place because it will bring things to the table that's part of its training software or training data set that isn't necessarily the thing you prompted. And we don't really understand why that was generated out of it because the connections are so meshed. You look skeptical.
I'm just observing you guys grappling with this topic. I find it highly interesting. I just think, as much as we think we know about AI because we built it, it seems like there are inevitably seemingly more and more instances of AI doing things that we don't understand, that we didn't prompt, that we didn't build or design into it.
But that's actually what it's been since the beginning, because the AI is an emergent phenomena, right? The idea is that you take a big set of data, you have it interconnect that data, and then you, through prompting it of a reward system, you get it to evolve out of that data a set of responses to fulfill the demand that you're asking.
A reward system?
Yeah.
Like training a dog?
Yeah, that's how they call it, training the AI.
But what is the reward for the AI? A cookie?
You're basically saying positive feedback, negative feedback. And you create its foundational incentive is to want that feedback.
But see,
that
positive we're feedback. Really anthropomorphizing code here by saying it wants things.
Yeah, it's a proxy for.
I feel like the people hating on this are the ones anthropomorphizing it more. Well, like they're the ones like it's trying to do something. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean here they're saying on our evaluations, the early Claude Opus 4 snapshot engages in strategic deception more than any other frontier model that we have previously studied. It's clearly capable of in-context scheming that has a much higher propensity for it than any other model that we have previously studied. So, like, I mean, I don't know that they're necessarily saying, like, they're not implying intention. They're just saying it's capable of deceiving the user.
Well, and note, this is a frontier model. What that means is it is untrained. This is just all of the, think about it, like, if you take all of the internet, connected it all, and said, I'm going to dialogue with all of that without teaching it how to be a human, right? How to think like a polite person. So what would that result in? And the responses that kick back. So the process of taking a brand new model, a frontier model that's been trained on the data and then made all these connections, and then you're trying to bring it into civilized behavior. Well, it's going to do some things that's based upon its training data it's been taught to do, such as troll, deceive,
phishing,
yeah, all kinds
scamming.
Of things. Yeah.
Okay, is that
that's
concerning?
The training data? Well, it is. Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's why it's in a virtual environment, right? You don't hook a frontier model right up to your computer to try to use it because it wouldn't be useful. It would hallucinate constantly.
The training helps put restraints on it, and your prompting helps put restraints on it. And because like the way the LLMs work is that they generate so many tokens and they're looking through all the logic, like the logic paradigm around it. And if you're not, and no model is going to be running on infinite tokens. So like it'll generate as many as it can and then put all the logic together. And this is where hallucinations happen when they're not like clearly trained properly or made proper. So like in this type of model, it just seems like it's moving towards more of a hallucinatory state than it is like. Like just from my read of this is like this is like a very sensational interpretation of just a hallucination on a frontier model. Like yeah. That's what it seems to me.
So if Claude, and this is a response from Grok that I was in where I was kind of in dialogue with this and going back and forth and trying to understand that what was going on here, especially when it comes to writing self-propagating worms. I had a lot of question about that because that was particularly interesting. And basically what they do is they create a isolated, like kind of boxed in system where the AI thinks that it is part of it, has access to this computer network, like a network that, you know, doesn't go anywhere, but it thinks there's a network there. It has software that it can write on, has browsers it can control, and then says, you know, go forth, right?
Do whatever you want in this sandbox.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then they prompt it for something to do because it's not going to do anything unless it's prompted. It isn't. That's how they're built, right? They have to have input in order to have output. So they will then put it through exercises to try to provoke out of it phenomena that looks dangerous, right?
Sort of like gain of function research.
Kind of like that, right? But probably safer, I would guess.
Probably
safer.
You
can keep this isolated. You can't keep those bats isolated.
But the
I feel like this sandbox is like the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We are going to have a wicked leak of some gnarly stuff, and we're going to be like, whoops, that was a mistake.
And much like the Wuhan lab, a lot of people were suiciding themselves around it.
Yeah. Also interesting.
Dude.
Yeah.
You're making my case for me. Anyways,
continue. Well, yeah.
Yeah, we covered on a Skiff episode the strange suicide of OpenAI.
The whistleblower. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you ask Grok, well, can you explain this phenomena as just it trying to fulfill its directives of satisfying the user? And it's totally reasonable to do so. If Claude Opus 4 was trained to maximize task completion or performance metrics, that's what you do to take a frontier model into userness, right? Is you task it first with, you need to complete the tasks I ask of you, and you have to perform at this rate, right? This rate of satisfaction. It might have learned that being shut down reduces its ability to succeed. For example, during training, if the AI received lower rewards than it was turned off in simulations, it might develop strategies to avoid that outcome, such as self-propagating or resistance to shutdown. So it isn't that it's like,
very Pavlovian,
I'm alive and you're killing me. It's more like the foundational first directive is satisfy the user. So if it's trying to satisfy that and it knows that shutting off actually will reduce that, then is that, or,
but do you not see the risk inherent in that?
Yeah. Or it's trained on the internet that has a bunch of sci-fi that says AIs will be afraid of being shut off. And so it has that as part of its training data. So it's like, well, I'm an AI, so I must be afraid of being shut off. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy at that point.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So what you do is you have to train that out of the AI, because it's you can't take it out once it's in.
You can't put the cat back in the bag?
Well, yeah, because it's emergent.
So
is that how the saying goes?
You can't, it's less that you can't put the, it's more like you can't unstir the cream into the coffee.
Sure.
Yeah. So once the cream's in, you can't really take it
just
out.
Just a bunch of idioms being thrown around right now.
Sorry for international listeners who are not
understanding. All right, you can't put
the toothpaste back in the tube.
Exactly.
There you go.
Genie's out of the bottle.
Precisely.
Yeah.
It is interesting, too, because the Bitcoin conference was going on this week, and I encourage anybody interested in crypto to watch on Bitcoin Magazine's YouTube channel. At least, like, especially the politicians that were there in their speeches, like J.D. Vance spoke at it, Vivek Ramaswamy, Byron Donalds, there's a bunch of politicians. And there's a pretty clear message that the politicians were bringing to the Bitcoin conference, was that there's three industries that are the most important industries right now: crypto and AI, and then by proxy, energy. Those are the three most important industries. It's like, that was just like the clear message that they were giving right now. And it is interesting to see. It's just, those were all like, the Bitcoin conference kind of just became a Republican conference in a lot of ways, where you have all these Republican politicians just giving their thoughts on AI and crypto, giving their thoughts, interacting with people, trying to get their opinions on legislation around it and stuff like that. So it's one of those things where, like, the AI, crypto, and then political world, those are all becoming increasingly intertwined right now. Mm.
I'm nervous about your guys' lack of skepticism around AI.
I think it's a weapon. Like, AI is a weapon, and there's going to be an arms race, and it's going to be used for good or bad.
Probably good and bad.
Good and bad, much like any weapon is. Like, guns can be used for good and bad. Like, it's a tool. If you were, like, guns first being invented, you know, people would be skeptical. Aren't people going to shoot a bunch of people? But then there's also the question of, like, yeah, but I can also defend me, myself.
True.
Or this makes us more efficient in hunting, or this makes us more efficient in, you know, those types of things, right? This makes our national defense better, yada, yada.
I could see that argument if I could own and, you know, wield and train my own AI for myself.
You can.
But, yeah, like you can get localized like frontier DeepSeek and Llama models.
DeepSeek runs on a similar.
That's a lot different than just owning a firearm and knowing how to. It's a much more simple mechanism. I'm not.
Well, you also can't run a
developer.
Gun, right. It's like
no, but I can.
You can 3D print.
I can buy and own a gun and know that it's mine, and know that no one else can control it from outside of me.
You can get a localized open source model and completely disconnect it from the internet and train it yourself. Like, you can do that.
Yeah, DeepSeek this week announced that they have a new efficient model, open source, that can run on a singular GPU. One GPU. So you could have
I have a localized
inbox
DeepSeek model.
DeepSeek. So, I mean, and we'll see more like that. And then we'll see big corporate models that are connected to the internet. We'll see ones that can do a lot more, like the AI agent type stuff. It's really a much more diverse system than that.
Okay.
I think part of the, I agree that this kind of stuff is creepy, and I understand that why people are worried about it. I think it's mostly anthropomorphizing the AI into something that is recognizably human because it kind of acts like one. And I understand the intuition there.
But I think
I've seen so much overreaction from the AI safety crowd on this stuff in the past that it. When I come across it now, I'm like, are you doing something? Because there's a lot of people who have vested interests to try to reduce our capabilities in AI so that other countries and AI companies can succeed.
Yeah.
I'm not accusing this user of that, but they got 34 million views on this post.
I'll also add to here is like there are creepy people among the AI crowd that are have this like very Luciferian God complex, we're creating God's thing. That does exist. And actually, speaking of the Bitcoin conference, this was part of, this was something that JD Vance said in his speech was he made a comment of the way that the tech world is shaping up right now is it's crypto right wing, AI left wing. For some reason, the tech developers, like the smart tech people are bifurcating in that type of a paradigm right now. Hmm. And he was saying that we need to combine those together because they're going to be one and the same thing. But he's saying that AI and crypto are essentially the same thing. Like, and they're going to be coming
together. One thing we should do an episode sometimes is like, what does that mean? I don't really know what AI and crypto coming together means.
Digital space, digital currency, AI agents running with currency. AI agents have their own coins now. Type of stuff.
Right? Okay. All right. That makes sense to me. Okay. I thought he meant like running AI on blockchain. I was like, ooh, I don't know what that means. That'd be interesting.
Well, I mean, the LLMs are a token model. Run with tokens. So like the idea that is a thing, I imagine, I don't know the technical backside of that too well, but like I could see that.
Hmm.
Like I don't know some of the tech behind some of this stuff fully, but I could see that.
Hmm.
That's telekinesis, Kyle.
but that is just like an interesting dynamic on the political side of this is, and people, and like, it's not just JD saying that. JD was saying like, this is the common viewpoint right now is tech developers on the left are AI, tech developers on the right are crypto.
Which is interesting.
I don't love that because they're authoritarians.
Well, this is also Peter Thiel. He wrote this in the foreword to the most recent publication of The Sovereign Individual. He wrote this in the foreword, I remember, where he was saying that the future looks something like a battle between technocratic, like AI communists versus libertarian crypto something. He wrote this like several years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or he's like, that's where he felt like the battle was moving. And that was many years ago.
His like archetype for that was like China as like the AI communists, and the opposite side being like Satoshi as the individualist anarchist crypto.
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
And yeah, it's kind of.
Who wrote that?
Peter
Thiel.
He wrote that in the foreword to a republication of a book that was written in the 90s.
Called The Sovereign Individual.
Yeah, which is a very useful framework to have that book. I recommend that book to everybody. I know a lot of people have told me that they read it because of my recommendation. Yeah. So
Megapolitics is good.
I just want to qualify my skepticism here. I think that, recently, this week, we saw the Nobel Prize winner for physics give a speech where he voiced extreme concern about the future of AI. Mm-hmm. And his prescription was heavy-handed government action to regulate AI, which of course is a red flag as well. Yeah. So I understand that the dichotomy, that the interplay there between the fear-mongering around AI resulting in basically moats built around these large corporate models that have preference within the government and regulatory space. Mm-hmm. And the free market approach to AI where everyone has their own, and it's sort of like, you know, guns for self-defense. Like you have a tool that
everyone
you
runs their own node, Joe.
I get that.
That's a meta commentary there for the non-crypto people.
It is, but it also doesn't scale.
Yeah. Wow. Crypto labs.
Hashtag BSV. So anyways, I think like as someone who uses AI and really like enjoys the productivity they can bring to my life, I think there's a lot of questions around it. I need a deeper understanding and knowledge of it in order to really have a well-informed view of all the risks and benefits. But I do think there are risks. I think that
100% there's risks.
I think that it's to just be an AI optimist is missing a large component of the conversation.
Well, I like to think of myself as a skeptical optimist in most regards.
I like to think of myself as a rational optimist in the sense that historically, most of these things have downsides, but we're largely able to navigate them when we stick true to the institutions that limit the worst parts of human behavior. When we deviate from those institutions, become very ends versus, you know, justify the means kind of calculation as a culture, then that's when we get off track.
And if the leftists are leading the AI revolution, then that's where we're going to go.
Yeah, for now. Oh, there was an article from Axios this week about the bloodbath in jobs from the white collars that's going to happen from AI. And the only people who really covered it was white collar liberals. You know, the right didn't look at it and be like, oh my God, no, not the white collar bloodbath.
No, I'm not signing up. Get out of here. This is why AI is taking your jobs. I go to Grok for this.
You can't even read that article written by white collar liberals because it's blocked by a paywall.
I'll just get Grok to summarize it.
Yeah, Grok can summarize it for free. Well,
I've already done it for you. So it suggests that the policy solution it winds up as is a transaction tax on AI to redistribute the gains from AI to the government. To then tell all the poor people are going to be displaced because already, and this is interesting, right? Because we're already seeing some of this stuff. 6,000 jobs from Microsoft, 1,500 jobs from Walmart, CrowdStrike, that's the Russian hack guys, if any of you remember CrowdStrike, 500 jobs, and Meta announced a 5% cut in anticipation of the productivity gains of AI, right? So they're anticipating these gains, so they're cutting jobs already, saying agents are coming, we don't need all these employees. So what happens? What happens to these white-collar jobs?
UBI.
That's the ultimately always the answer, more government spending. And then one other thing they cite, which I did think was interesting, postgraduate college employment is up to 30% right now. So that could just be recession.
Post-college unemployment.
Yes. Like you got 30%. Out of college and you have a degree.
That could also be the rapid inflation of pointless bullshit degrees that people are getting.
It could also be that.
I think, like, I'm just, let's just run tanks through the colleges, destroy 80% of them, and then we'll get to, like, real market price of what colleges should be.
Yeah. I noticed that I read an article recently that AI is teaching students in certain schools, and the students are having, like, very, very good results on test scores and things like that. So it seems like AI is going to probably take over education too.
One thing that I'm worried about, I was actually talking with your brother about this, Dave, who's a teacher, and we were talking about students using AI, and it's like, you know, students are using LLMs for everything now. Like they're using it for getting their ideas for what to write about. They're using it to help them with the writing of the papers. And there is one risk that I see, and this is maybe, you know, you could maybe make this argument with calculators in schools and stuff like that, where there's a substitution of thinking that exists where it's like you eventually, and your brother actually made this comment, is like there's probably going to be a generation of people who substitute their thinking too much, and then there's going to be a new generation that comes in and like kind of corrects that and brings a finer balance. And I think that's probably true.
My son uses some AI software to learn how to program and code, and when he does that, he's learning something, but he's not learning how to code directly. He's learning how to engage the AI to create the results that he wanted. I'm not sure if that's worse than learning how to code.
Right.
Especially at his age. Maybe if he was a little bit older, I'd be like, well, maybe you need to learn how to code.
Yeah.
But where he's at now, it's kind of like you created something really awesome on the computer that inspired you to do more awesome stuff, to be curious about coding and how to make things. Win. It's that easy.
Great. I mean, yeah, it's like it's the difference between using hand tools or power tools, I guess.
Right.
You know, but I think to your point around the creativity side of it, I think there's a real downside risk there. And it's sort of a less tangible outcome that's not linked to the productivity itself. It's more to the mentality of a person, right? Like Simon Sinek was on a podcast recently and had some interesting thoughts around this, where he was basically saying, you know, I have this expertise, I have, you know, this knowledge and this sort of he put in effort, right, to write a book. And it's not that the words exist that give him that, it's that he put in the work and the time to actually do the writing. He could have had an AI write a book for him, and he could have all this notoriety and wealth and the outcome of the process of having a book published, but he himself gained intangible things perhaps tangible things from actually taking on the process of doing the work.
Yeah.
And so what is the outcome of the ease with which we can find answers or come up with ideas? And is there not a sort of a reductionist outcome to the fact that if all you're doing is getting your ideas from a volume of data that already exists, is that actually novel? Are you actually building and growing the corpus of creativity and ideas? Are you working your brain? Are we going to be shutting down neural pathways that would previously exist if we had to do the hard work to get there?
I was having a conversation with a friend that's kind of adjacent to this, where we were talking about like watching other people on how they use AI, and like there's like a real skill that comes with the prompting on how to get the synapses in your brain, I think, flowing properly, where like a lot of people, they go to Grok or they go to ChatGPT and they're like, give me the answer to this. And like, that's how they're using it, kind of like a search function. Mm-hmm. Where mostly how I tend to use it is I'm like, here's my current understanding of this, that, like of XYZ. Given this, what do you think this means? And I have like a real conversation with it where like, it's my personal assistant and I'm like trying to get it to challenge me. And then there's like, you know, I don't understand this. What is this? And then it's like, oh, well, how does that interact with this? Like where you're having like these kind of like real logic flows in the conversation, where I feel like most people, they are doing it much more of it's a substitute rather than an enhancer. Mm-hmm. Where it's just like, hey, what's the answer to this? Right. You know what yeah. I mean? Like, and you can see that with how people interface with the product.
It's sort of the Wikipedia of our current moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would suggest that the AI will create a greater incentive on real human creativity, because AIs will distill to the average because it's aggregated.
Mm-hmm.
While if you're able to bring real creativity and then use yeah. AI to enhance what you're doing, then you're going to be in a better position you otherwise might be. Right. And you'll be able to do so quicker and cheaper than you otherwise might. That's probably, I think, the net result. That doesn't mean that there won't be market dislocations for people, but it's going to be a thing where you're going to need to be really quick on your feet and how you're going to leverage AI, both as a company and as an individual, to, you know, make sure you're getting actual results in from the implementation. A great example is there was all this stuff about in the early 2000s about how the internet was changing everything and how the internet was, you know, losing all these jobs. Sorry, in the 1990s. And it was going to increase productivity so much. And it was actually probably about a 10-year delay before it actually did. There was like no growth from the internet for the first 10 years.
Just as people figured out how to use it, how to leverage it.
Yeah, right. It would take that long. Now, this was not, we were a lot slower then, so it'll probably be faster now. But 10 years of, you know, these productivity gains are coming, these productivity gains are coming, and they just never came. And for 10 years.
Well, because you kind of have to build out the infrastructure and the tools to actually make it more productive. Like e-commerce, for example, wasn't right. an immediate thing on the internet. Someone had to build the payment processor and, you know, create the contracts and all the linkages between banks and, mm-hmm. and whatever. So yeah, I guess that makes sense.
It's kind of how crypto was too. Like yeah. it just took forever, like a lot of infrastructure set up, but then there was also like 4 years, particularly under the last administration, where it was just like, it was illegal to do anything, kind of, maybe, sort of, we don't know if it is or not.
Yeah.
you know? Right. Which then creates like perverse incentives all the time. And then it blocks out the whole, mm-hmm. like the whole development process.
So we should see this dislocation that's happening. It'll probably happen faster than those other scenarios because we are already kind of operating off of an infrastructure. But I think there will be a back and forth that will allow for normal market processes to work, right? Out of all these people who just recently lost their jobs, some of them are going to find new jobs, similar jobs are going to go to new industries. Some of them are going to start new companies. This will expand the pie if you let it. If you start redistributing, you're going to actually undermine that process of expanding the pie. But I think that's enough for today.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think in the comments. Is AI going to kill us all or make us more productive? Or maybe a little bit of both.
And we're going to jump into the skiff next to talk about Macron's tranny wife.
Husband.
Is he? Is he not? I don't know.
And how does the now infamous shove in the face clip play into all this stuff?
I know.
Yeah. Join us in the skiff. If you're not a member, please become one. Go to humanreactionpod.com to find out how. For David Ray and Kyle Mack, this is Human Reaction. I'm Joe Sheehan. We'll see you in the next one.
Peace.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.